Now we'll go on to the third chapter, which is about cells and tissues. And this should be the last whirlwind chapter. This is the last of these introductory ones, because starting with the next chapter and then for the rest of the term, we are going to spend one chapter at a time studying one organ system at a time. So this first unit is weird compared to all the other units because it has all this introductory information. So there's a lot of slides in here, but a lot of them are just picture examples. So we're going to kind of blow through them pretty quickly. Okay, now in slide one we have a picture of a generalized animal cell. This is an animal cell because that's what we are. We're studying humans in here, and so we have animal cells. We won't bother to look at plant or any other kind of cells. But do remember that we talked about the dichotomy of cell types, right? Overall, in biology, there are two major categories of cells. Do you remember what I'm talking about? Eukaryotic and prokaryotic cells. Remember these words? And remember that word is, the meanings of those words is based on whether or not the cell has a true nucleus. Eukaryotic means having a true nucleus, prokaryotic not. Well, that's true. Prokaryotic cells do not have a true nucleus, eukaryotic cells do, but that's not the only difference. The nucleus, if a cell has one, is just one example of a membrane-bounded organelle. Now, organelles, that word by itself, just means little organ. It's like an organ within a cell. Just like a liver is an organ within the body, the cell has little parts within it, and those are called organelles. A membrane-bounded organelle is an organelle that is enclosed by or bounded by its own membrane. And the nucleus is one example of that. Well, not only do prokaryotic cells not have a true nucleus, they also don't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. Only eukaryotic cells do. And so we'll look at other examples of membrane-bounded organelles in this chapter, but prokaryotic cells don't have that. All cells, though, remember, have a plasma membrane. That's really what defines the cell, right? That's the boundary between that cell and everything else in the universe. So even prokaryotic cells have that, but that's the only membrane that prokaryotic cells have. So they, each cell of a prokaryotic cell is just one chamber, one compartment. Since eukaryotic cells have multiple membranes, multiple membrane-bounded organelles, that means the interior of the cell is actually several compartments because these other membranes form little sub-compartments within the cell. Okay, that's what we're looking. That's what humans are because we are animals and all animals are eukaryotes. The nucleus is shown in detail here, but we'll get a better view of it in a second. The nucleus, though, for cells that have them, which we do, is where we find DNA. The nucleus, by the way, is not only an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. It actually is an example, there's a few of these, that is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. You can see it kind of right here. There's two layers of membrane there. So that double membrane that defines the nucleus is called the nuclear envelope. It's not labeled there, but that's what it's called. In slide two, we see that it's labeled nuclear envelope. This is just a closer view. So this whole cell isn't shown here, just the nucleus and this gray stuff. And the reason the gray stuff is shown here along with the nucleus is because it's connected to the nucleus. The nuclear envelope is made out of membrane, and membrane material is really the same, whether it's plasma membrane or the membrane of any of these other membrane-bounded organelles. It's all made of the same stuff. Well, the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, you can see here, every so often folds out and becomes the membrane that makes up this totally other membrane-bounded organelle that's shown in gray here. That one in gray is called the endoplasmic reticulum. Whoops, endo. And so that's why they're shown together. They share, really, a membrane. Notice also in the purple nucleus that the nuclear envelope is perforated or full of holes. Those holes are called nuclear pores, and that is important for reasons I'll talk about later. Things have to get into and out of the nucleus, basically, is why it's full of pores. Let's go on to three, though, and look at a very close-up view of just part of the plasma membrane. So the cell here would be bigger than this room, because we're just looking at a tiny little slice of its plasma membrane. To the top is the exterior of the cell, this is the interior of the cell. And what we see here is that the main substructure of the of any membrane, including the plasma membrane, is two layers of phospholipids. Remember talking about phospholipids the last time? We talked about, you know, we blew through lipids as a category, and there's different important kinds of lipids, but one of those I said was impossible to overstate the importance of, which were the phospholipids. Very similar to fats, right? Fats have three hydrocarbon tails, but phospholipids have only two. And that third connection point with the glycerol is made with a phosphate group, which has a charge. And that's why, in cartoon form, they're drawn as a polar head with two nonpolar tails. That's a single phospholipid. And the reason this is, we all living things owe their lives to this, is because these things, if you have a bunch of them in the presence of water, without any living thing, just molecules in water, they will automatically, they will self-assemble into what we call a phospholipid bilayer. Two layers of phospholipids arranged so that the tails of one layer are facing the tails of the other layer, and the polar heads are facing outward. Okay, that's the reason they do that is because these tails, being nonpolar, unlike water, do not like to be around water. So they're trying to avoid it. They like being around each other because they're all nonpolar, but they don't want to be around the polar water. The polar heads have no problem being around water. So this is water outside, this is water inside, and that's how the first protocells came to be. This is how cells were created originally. Once these phospholipids accumulated on early Earth to the point that they were just forming these little bags, that's how you was an important step in the first cells coming to be. So that happens automatically, but a living cell can't have just a membrane that's just phospholipids, because certain things can get through the phospholipid bilayer, either into or out of the cell, but other things can't. And some of those things that can't are things that cells absolutely have to get into or out of themselves. That's why a full membrane is more than just phospholipids. In addition, you have other things, including, importantly, these big purple things, which are proteins that are embedded in the membrane. And those are therefore called membrane-bound proteins, which is different from the phrase membrane-bounded. They're not enclosed by their own membranes. They are part of the membrane. And these membrane-bound proteins do different jobs, but among the most important jobs is that they allow things that can't get directly through the phospholipid layer into or out of the cell through the membrane. All right, now let's look at slide four. Some three important kinds of intercellular junctions. Now, a junction is just a place where something joins, and intercellular means between cells. Inter means between. So animal cells feature three major categories that we'll talk about of intercellular junctions, one of which is the desmosomes. Desmosomes, there's more than one shown here. This is one. Desmosomes are complexes of proteins that are connected to one cell's plasma membrane and also connected to the next adjacent cell's plasma membrane. And they're really functioning just like spot welds. You know, rather than welding something completely, you just make a spot weld, which holds it together in just one place. That's what desmosomes are doing. So they're all about keeping cells together to maintain the integrity of a tissue. Remember that cells make up tissues.
Okay. A similar complex of proteins, but much more complex, is a tight junction.
The tight junction,
notice these purple beads, that goes all the way around the cell.
So if you have a cell surrounded by other cells, the tight junction is kind of like double-sided tape, all the way around, sticking to that cell and also sticking to the other cells around it. And even though these do kind of hold the cells together, that's not really their function. That's the function of desmosomes. So it's not for mechanical rigidity. Instead, the tight junctions form blockades, really. Now, I've been using the word membrane over and over to mean something microscopic, right? The membrane of a cell. But you can also use membrane to mean something macroscopic, made up of multiple cells. Like an epithelium, for instance, which we'll look at today, is many cells. It's, you know, like the epidermis of your skin is an epithelium. That's a membrane, but it's a much bigger membrane than the cell membrane, okay? So I'm using the word differently. But however many cells are involved to make up that macroscopic membrane, if you are a particle trying to pass through that macroscopic membrane, that multicellular membrane, then you really have two choices. You could, if you're able to, enter one of the cells of that membrane, right? Go through the width of that cell, exit it, and go through another one, and then you're through the whole membrane, right? The only other possibility, if you're going to be successful, is to try to squeeze in the spaces between cells. Okay? Well, that's exactly what tight junctions function to prevent. That, like, stuff that I'm saying is like double-sided tape will block that route between the cells. And so they'll get up to the tight junction, but they can't get past it. And therefore, if they aren't able to actually enter cells, then they won't be able to get through that epithelium or multicellular membrane. And then the third one on this picture is a intercellular junction called a gap junction. And all three of these kinds are just complexes of proteins. But gap junctions proteins are arranged in a way that form little tunnels. And so these are also not really about holding the cells together. That's the job of desmosomes. Gap junctions are about intercellular communication. If cells can trade materials, then that's a form of communication. And so certain particles that are the right size and kind are able to go through these little tunnels formed by gap junctions. And this is, for instance, how your heart works. It's important for your heart to be able to contract all at once to function as a pump. You don't want just some of the heart contracting one moment and then the next moment the rest of it. So ions flow through gap junctions to make that happen synchronously. Okay, let's go on to five. This is an overview. This is a whole cell, but it's kind of a catch-all picture because not every cell in your body is going to have all of these things, but these are the major organelles that we'll study in this chapter. We've already talked about the nuclear envelope and the fact that it is membrane-wise continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum. That's the blue thing. We can see that in this picture as well. All I did so far was mention the endoplasmic reticulum. I haven't said what it does. Well, it actually has two parts and they do different things. So the overall endoplasmic reticulum is one organelle, but there are two drastically different parts to it, one of which is called the rough endoplasmic reticulum, one of which is called the smooth. And the roughness, when you look at it under a microscope, comes from the fact that the rough endoplasmic reticulum on its membrane is studded with a bunch of these little brown dots in this picture, which are organelles themselves. They're tiny organelles, though, called ribosomes. And ribosomes, even though they're organelles, they're not membrane-bounded organelles. Okay? So even prokaryotic cells have ribosomes. But What is a ribosome? Well, it is a tiny molecular machine, really, that is responsible for assembling proteins. I've said a couple times, I think, that all the major jobs in your cell are done by proteins of various kinds, right? It's proteins that actually give you your traits. Well, those proteins don't just pop into existence. They have to be built by the cell, one amino acid at a time. Remember that the monomers of proteins are amino acids. You have to know which amino acids to use, how many, and in which order in order to make a specific protein. That's done at a ribosome. Okay? So the rough ER features the bunch of ribosomes, and that makes sense because the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify proteins that have just been made. Because some proteins, not all, but some proteins, after they're produced at ribosomes, they need to be modified in some way before they can actually do their job. Like something else needs to be stuck on them, or something needs to be cut off of them, whatever. Modification. And that is performed inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is why these ribosomes are there. They're stringing in the proteins that they're building, and then those newly made proteins are modified by the rough endoplasmic reticulum. That's not what the job of the smooth ER is. It's smooth because it doesn't have those ribosomes associated with it, but also notice, instead of being flattened sacs, it really looks like a bunch of tubes. It's all the same membrane, though. It's a very intricate membrane. The job of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, there's a couple major jobs, is to produce lipids. One for one thing, but also it's a storage place for various things, including calcium ions, which becomes really important. Your muscles can't work without storing calcium ions when at rest and then releasing them to the rest of the cell. That's done in the smooth ER. Okay, now the Golgi complex is the green one. I said Golgi complex, that's one of its names. You can also call it the Golgi apparatus. Some books just call it the Golgi, which is the name of a dead Italian that it's named for. But the Golgi, whatever you call it, any one of those is allowable. The Golgi complex is something that looks structurally just like the rough ER, and it's right next to it. But it has a different job. I already told you that the rough ER's job is to modify proteins, right? Once they're modified, the rough ER packages those proteins in little bags made out of membranes. And little bag of membrane we call a vesicle. So that's kind of a general word. But the membrane that makes up the wall of the vesicle that contains these modified proteins, that membrane used to be part of the rough ER's membrane. It just buds off of it. And then that package of modified proteins in a vesicle goes next to the Golgi complex, which really operates much like a receiving and shipping center. You know, receiving, that you're bringing things in, shipping, you're sending them out to the appropriate place. So this is what the Golgi does. It receives these vesicles from the rough ER, figures out where they need to go, which means, do these things need to be actually secreted all the way out of the cell? Do they need to be put into the plasma membrane? Or do they need to go to another organelle? The Golgi figures that out and then repackages them in a new vesicle that buds off of the Golgi's membrane, and it goes into the appropriate place. See these vesicles right here? Those have been budded off of the Golgi. Okay, next to that is these orange bean-shaped things, which there can be some, any number of in a cell. Those are mitochondria. That's the plural word, IA. Mitochondrion is just the singular, so that's just one of them. But a mitochondrion is another example of not only a membrane-bounded organelle, but a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, just like the nucleus. It has two membranes. But in terms of function, this is often by textbooks called the powerhouse of the cell. When we get energy out of the food that we eat, what we're doing is really breaking apart the molecules that that food is made of. First, we digest it into small enough particles, those monomer molecules that they're made out of. That's just to get it into our body. Then once it's in the cell, those monomers are completely dismantled, atom by atom. That's how we get the energy out of them. And most of that occurs in the mitochondrion. So most of the ATP that we make, which stores the energy from our food, like I said earlier, most of that happens in mitochondria in a process called cellular respiration. That's the major function of mitochondria, cellular respiration. And by the way, when that happens, it's an efficient process that gets as much energy as possible out of the food because it's a complete dismantling of the carbons and the hydrogens that make up those fuel molecules. So it started as food. By the time it gets done in cellular respiration in the mitochondria, the only thing that's left over are carbon dioxide molecules. So you already know that you exhale carbon dioxide, right? Well, where does it come from? It used to be the food you ate. It's food that has been so dismantled that we've taken the energy out of it. And it's worthless to us as energy at that point, so we get rid of it. Peroxisomes up on the bottom and lysosome up here, they look the same. They're vesicles, really, but they have slightly different jobs. A lysosome, the zone part of that, means body, by the way. Lyse, as we already talked about, means split. So a lysosome, or splitting body, is literally what it means, is an organelle in which digestion of or breakdown of molecules takes place. Now that's a process that requires certain enzymes, right, which are proteins that help out in chemical reactions. These digestive enzymes that break things apart, those are dangerous things to have around the rest of the important parts of the cell because they might start digesting the cell itself, right? So these digestive enzymes are locked away from the rest of the cell in these things called lysosomes so that it can happen safely. Peroxisomes do a similar thing. They're named for the fact that they deal with harmful peroxides that build up as a natural part of the cell's activities, would be toxic otherwise, so the peroxides are chemically converted into something safer within peroxisomes. And now we have also two of three kinds of protein fibers that we're going to look at that make up what is called the cytoskeleton. Now, cytoskeleton is one of many words with this CYT root. What does that mean? Anyone know what cyte or cyto means?
Small.
No, it means cell. For instance, the study of cells is cytology. But you see that cyte in a bunch of words, like a liver cell, for instance, is called a hepatocyte. Hepato means of the liver, cyte means cell. The cytoskeleton is much like your overall skeleton. It's not bony, of course. It's not a hard skeleton. But it's acting like the skeleton within the cell because it's a support structure. So the cell, you should never think of the cell as being kind of a bag of stuff that is just randomly moving around. There's a high degree of order in any cell, partly because you have a cytoskeleton to maintain that order. But the cytoskeleton, structurally speaking, is made out of three major kinds of fibrous proteins. Only two of them are listed here, but we'll look at all three. Those are microtubules, shown here, microfilaments, and intermediate filaments. Those make up the cytoskeleton. And I'm not even going to bother mentioning centrioles, but cytosol, I just wanted to tell you that the cytosol, that's really just the liquid part of the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is all the stuff that's inside the cell but outside of other organelles. So the main interior of the cell is the cytoplasm, and the liquid part of that is just called the cytosol. That's where the chemistry that is life occurs in the cytosol, much of it. All right. Let's go to 6 now. Here we see a close-up view of what I was talking about happening at the endoplasmic reticulum. A ribosome is busy building a protein, one amino acid at a time, which is being strung into the hollow interior of the endoplasmic reticulum so that it can then modify it and package it in its own vesicle that buds off of the membrane of the ER. So now this vesicle is on its way to the Golgi complex to figure out where it needs to go. What we can see in 7, the Golgi complex is receiving vesicles from that bud off of the ER. Since membrane material is all made out of the same stuff, it can fuse into other membrane material, which is why one that buds off of the ER can now fuse into the Golgi complex, spilling its contents into it. The Golgi recognizes where it needs to go and then packages into a new vesicle. And if that particle, whatever it is, needs to be secreted, meaning moved all the way out of the cell, then it will be contained within a vesicle, because when that vesicle then merges or fuses with the plasma membrane and unfolds, it will just spill its contents all the way out. Okay? If, on the other hand, the particles need to be part of or tied to the membrane to become membrane-bound proteins, the plasma membrane I'm talking about, then they will actually be bound to the membrane of the vesicle, so that when the vesicle unfolds and fuses with the plasma membrane, that the proteins are now part of the membrane. That's how you get the proteins in there. And you can take them up later. You know, the plasma membrane is also highly dynamic, continuously changing moment to moment based on the needs. By the way, that process of using vesicles to spill things out of the cell, like we see here, that is called exocytosis. But exocytosis is a particular example of an even more general transport process called vesicular transport. Vesicular is just the adjective of vesicle. So, transport of something into or out of a cell using a vesicle, that's in general what we call vesicular transport. All right? Vesicular transport then can be subdivided into two major kinds based only on the direction of transport, whether it's into or out of the cell. If it's vesicular transport that's moving something out of the cell, we call that exocytosis. Exo meaning out, cyte once again meaning cell. Okay? Well, there's an opposite of that, because you can use vesicles to bring things into the cell as well. But that's called endocytosis. Movement of things into the cell via a vesicle. And we'll have pictures of these coming up. First, though, let's look at slide 8, which is a close-up of these three major categories of fibrous proteins I was talking about that make up the cytoskeleton. I'm not going to get too deeply into what the different jobs are here, but the three types are called microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. As you can see by the cartoon version of them, microtubules have the widest diameter of the fiber. Microfilaments have the narrowest diameter. They're the thinnest. And that's why we call the third one intermediate filaments. They're of intermediate diameter. And there's all three of them are important for different reasons, but that complex network of these three make up what we call collectively the cytoskeleton. Okay, now we're going to go through several slides just to look at examples of important jobs or functions that different kinds of cells perform. There's all kinds of different cells, as you know, in the body, hundreds, a couple hundred types of cells. They do different categories of jobs in general. For instance, there are cells that connect body parts, like these fibroblasts that are shown here. Connecting things together is their job. Now, included in that are these blood cells that aren't really mechanically connecting things, but they are functionally connecting things because red blood cells pick up oxygen from the lungs, dump carbon dioxide into the lungs, then connect that oxygen with the cells of the body that need it. They'll drop it off to those cells and pick up carbon dioxide from those cells, then go back to the lungs. So connecting body parts is one important cell function. Slide 10 shows another, cells that cover and line body organs. These, as we'll see a little bit later, are what we call epithelial tissues. Lining body organs can be either exterior lining or interior lining. We're all familiar with an exterior lining that we call the epidermis. That's just part of your skin, by the way. The epidermis and the skin are not exactly the same thing. The epidermis is just part of the skin. But it lines the exterior surface and saves our lives because of that, because it protects us from invasion by microorganisms, among other things. Well, you also have linings interiorly, like the alimentary canal that I said is really outside of your body, right? The mouth to anus tube. That has an inner lining as well, that's made up of cells that line the body. 11, cells that move organs and body parts. So these involve muscles or muscle-like cells. When this happens, the muscle cells, what we call a muscle is a bunch of cells, but it's made up of muscle cells. And muscle cells are able to move things because they're able to shorten or contract. That's the only thing that muscle cells are able to do on their own, by the way. They can't push. They can't actively get longer. To get longer, something else has to pull on them. You know, like for instance, I shorten this muscle right here called the biceps brachii in order to bend my elbow. If I just then quit making this muscle contract by stopping my intention, then gravity will just make this fall, and that's what stretches it back. The muscle doesn't push. Muscles only pull. And we'll talk about three kinds of muscle cells in a little bit, muscle tissue, but we're in the cells part. Slide 12, cells that store nutrients. Perfect example of this is this. This is an adipocyte, or you can just call it a fat cell, but they're called adipocytes because they are cells that make up tissue called adipose tissue. So adipocyte means adipose cell. A fat cell is specialized for containing as much fat as possible, which is why all the other organelles get squeezed to the side. This big droplet is a bunch of fat molecules, which we've already looked at fat, right? And the fat is a really efficient way of storing energy. It has a higher energy density than the other nutrient molecules. Right, if you think about nutrients on food labels, there's major categories. Carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, right? Proteins and carbohydrates do not have nearly as high an energy density, which means if we take in more energy than we need, and if we were to store that extra energy in the form of either proteins or carbohydrates, we would have to weigh a lot more than we do because it would take more mass to store that amount of energy. If we store it as fat instead, we don't weigh nearly as much, and we therefore don't require as much energy to move around. So it's much more efficient. That's one major reason why we store fat. Another is that fat cells, adipose tissue that fat cells makes, is important for padding. It pads delicate organs and keeps them from being injured. So we have fat pads around specific organs for that reason. And it also provides thermal insulation, keeping us either warmer than the environment or cooler than the environment, depending on what the conditions are. It minimizes heat exchange between us and the environment. Okay, 13, cells that fight disease. Now, specifically, the cells that fight disease are any of five kinds of white blood cells. And white blood cells are called leukocytes in general. Once again, cyte meaning cell, but leuko means white. On the other hand, red blood cells are called erythrocytes, and the erythro part of that means red. Well, as you already saw when you looked at the scopes last time, if you look at a blood smear, you see almost nothing but red blood cells. because they vastly outnumber white blood cells. Even though you have millions and millions of white blood cells, you have a hell of a lot more red blood cells. All red blood cells are the same in your body, but there are five major categories of white blood cells, or leukocytes, and they are involved in immunity. They produce proteins that will help to kill invaders that might harm you. Not only that, but if you survive that original attack by a microorganism, if you don't die from whatever that disease is, then your white blood cells store that memory of them having invaded you, and they keep an army of special proteins called antibodies on hand in your blood, so that if you get invaded by that same kind of organism in the future, they'll just overwhelm it and kill it before you see any effects. This is exactly the basis for vaccinations, right? In a vaccination, you're given something that's been killed, so it can't give you the disease, but the body still recognizes it as the invader, and it will be just like you were infected, and you'll build those antibodies up, and therefore, if the real living thing attacks you later, you won't get sick, and you'll survive that. Okay, so that's cells that fight disease. 14, cells that gather information and control body functions. Now, there's two major control organ systems in the body. What are those? The two organ systems whose job it is to control the other organ systems.
Nervous
system and the endocrine system, exactly. And so both of these have cells that control other cells, but in different ways. What you're looking at here is a neuron, and a neuron has a large cell body because that's where the nucleus is. It has to be bigger. And then a couple things that hang off of it, a long axon and several dendrites. They have this weird shape because neurons send electrochemical signals to other cells, including other neurons. You know, there are billions of these making up your brain. This is why you have your personality, why you're able to think, because these things are continuously firing, these electrochemical signals. The cells of the endocrine system also operate by signals, but those are chemical signals, not electrochemical signals. They're not voltages. They are just chemicals that are released into the bloodstream. We call them hormones, and they travel to cells, and if they meet up with the correct kind of receptor, changes will be made. This is how the control of other organ systems is exercised. So that's a major job of some cells. And then 15 is cells of reproduction. You're looking at a sperm here. An egg would be another cell of reproduction. What do we call sex cells in general?
Gametes,
right. Gamete is the unisex term, in other words. Male gamete is sperm, female gamete is egg. And reproduction, sexual reproduction, results from the fusion of two gametes of opposite type. When a male and female gamete fuses, that forms one cell that now houses the DNA from both of those gametes, and therefore from both parents. And that one cell is the official beginning of a new life. That's where you became you, when that one cell was formed by your two parents' gametes, and that one cell is called a zygote. So that's a major function of some cells. It's an optional one, by the way. You don't have to reproduce, but you're able to. 16 now. A little bit of a shift in gears. What we're looking at here is a cartoon example of an important process called diffusion. Now, this is using just like a sugar cube in water. But diffusion is an example of a passive process as opposed to an active process. Passive process means that the energy required for that diffusion is already contained within the system. You don't have to supply any additional energy. Okay, it will happen on its own. But what diffusion is or results in is the spreading out of particles from where they are more closely packed together or more highly concentrated to where they are less highly concentrated. And this happens just because of random motion of particles. Okay? Which all particles are moving when you get down to the microscopic scale. So when you plunk a sugar cube into water, at first there's a very high concentration of sugar right there and very low in the water, right? So it diffuses away from the sugar cube into the water, and simultaneously there's a high concentration of water where there's water and very low where there's sugar. So water is diffusing in the opposite direction toward the sugar, and when you let this go for a while, it'll be all mixed up. That's diffusion. And notice there's no membrane involved here, but there can be, like you see in slide 17. Diffusion can occur, in other words, through a membrane to get something either into a cell or out of a cell. Things can diffuse into or out of cells. And this is important because, as I said, cells need to get certain things into or out of them to remain alive. Well, here you have a little piece of the membrane that you see is just only phospholipids. I already told you that a complete membrane will have other things in it as well. But right here, all we see is phospholipids. And that's because certain kinds of particles are able to get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. Only if a couple things are true, though. The particle has to, first of all, be small enough. If it's too big, it's just not going to get through, directly through the phospholipids. So if it's small enough, it might be able to get through, but something else has to be true. It also has to be nonpolar, or sufficiently nonpolar. Remember that the tails of the phospholipids are nonpolar, which is why they are trying to avoid water on the inside and outside of the cell, right? So if a particle is small enough and it's also nonpolar, then it will have no problem slipping through here because it doesn't mind being around those tails. All right? So if that's true, if it's small enough and it's nonpolar, particles will be able to diffuse right through the membrane. And what determines whether they'll go into the cell or go out of the cell is what is called a gradient. Gradient is another kind of a general word that really just means a difference in some sort of measurement. For instance, there's a pressure gradient when you turn on a faucet. It's higher water pressure inside than outside, which is why it always comes out. Water doesn't go in to the spigot when you turn it off. Okay? It's going down its gradient, we say, when it's operating passively. And so there are also such things as concentration gradients, meaning that if the fluid on one side of the membrane has a higher concentration of that particle than the other side does, then that particle is going to diffuse to where there's less of it. It diffuses down its gradient always. That's a passive process. So it just depends on where the higher concentration is as to whether it'll go into or out of the cell. But it'll go directly through the phospholipid bilayer if it's small enough and if it's nonpolar. That's not always true, though. And that's why, as I said before, we can't just have nothing but phospholipids making up our membranes. In slide 18, we see something called osmosis. Now, that's a different word than diffusion, obviously, but it's really just a special case of diffusion. Osmosis is diffusion. But it's a special case, so not all diffusion is osmosis. The thing that's different when we use the word osmosis, there's two things that make it osmosis. One is that the particle that's diffusing is not a solute. Instead, it's a solvent, which is water, right? In biological solutions, the solvent is always water. The solutes are the things being dissolved by the water, right? Well, if it's water itself that's moving, which is the solvent, and if it's moving through a membrane to do that, then it's osmosis. But it's still passive. All diffusion is passive, including osmosis. So that means water, by osmosis, always moves from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. And that can be either into or out of the cell, depending on the situation. Okay, that's also diffusion. Speaking of moving either into or out of the cell, in 19 we can see a red blood cell, or an erythrocyte, in three different situations. It has three different environments, or exterior solutions that it's being bathed in. The first one, which is a normal red blood cell, this is how you want your red blood cells to look, because this is a healthy one. This is in what is called an isotonic solution. Iso, by itself, means same. And the tonicity part of the word refers to the tendency for water to move in one direction or another. So an isotonic solution is a solution that is just as the same wateriness as the interior of the cell itself. And if it's just as watery, there really is no water gradient. There's no difference. So water moves into the cell and out of the cell at the same rate. It's just a swap. And it doesn't change the volume of the cell, right? You're just moving in both directions at once. That's not what's happening on the other two pictures, though. In the middle, we have a red blood cell in what is called a hypertonic solution. A hypertonic solution has a higher solute concentration than the cell. But notice what that means. A higher solute concentration, like if you're talking about salt water, for instance. Higher salt concentration means more salty water, right? The more salt you have in it, the less watery it is. So a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell itself. And therefore, when water moves by osmosis, it's always going to move from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. In this case, it's less watery outside the cell, so the water leaves the cell, and that shrinks it. That shrinkage, by the way, of a cell in a hypertonic solution is called crenation, with an N. And if it's severe enough, that will kill the cell, which is obviously bad. The opposite problem is when a red blood cell is in a hypotonic solution. Hypotonic solutions have a lower solute concentration than the cell, which is a backwards way of saying that they are more watery than the cell, right? And therefore, once again, water is going to move to where it's less watery, but in this case, it's less watery in the cell. So when a cell's in a hypotonic solution, it will take on water, and this will swell it up. And it might even burst it, because the plasma membrane's pretty flimsy. It can only hold so much pressure. And if it does actually burst it, we call that lysis. Once again, splitting, right? Lysis kills the cell. Obviously also bad. So it's important to maintain extracellular fluid as an isotonic solution so that the cells don't take on or lose water. They instead have the right amount. And this is an important part of overall homeostasis. We've talked about maintaining body temperature. You also have to maintain pH, or you also have to maintain isotonicity. Everything we've looked at so far on transport processes have been passive. Slide 20 is still passive, and you can tell that because it uses the word diffusion. Remember, I said all diffusion is passive. But what's different here is that the types of particles cannot get through the phospholipid bilayer, either because they're too big or because they are polar or charged, which is even beyond polar, or both. Big by itself is prohibitive. Charged by itself, even if you're small, is prohibitive. And if you're both big and charged, you're not going to get through directly either. Well, a lot of those things that can't get directly through still need to get into or out of the cell, and that's why you need these proteins embedded in the membrane. And we call them transport proteins because their job is to transport particles into and out of the cell. If that transport happens passively by diffusion, then we call it facilitated diffusion, just to distinguish it from simple diffusion, which would be directly through the phospholipid bilayer. Facilitated diffusion simply means it's Still diffusion, but something is facilitating it or helping it. The thing that's facilitating it is the transport protein. All right, but it's still passive transport because the transport protein isn't making it move in a direction it does not want to move. It's still moving down its gradient from where it's highly concentrated to where it's less highly concentrated. Well, now we can get to 21, which is the opposite of that. Passive transport happens on its own because it has its own built-in energy. Active transport is called active transport because you are actively forcing that to happen. Active transport moves things against their gradient. You don't have to force water to flow downhill, right? It passively falls downhill, down its gravitational gradient. Sometimes, though, you want to move water uphill. That's never going to happen on its own. You're going to have to force it to do that. You're going to have to put some energy into that. And we do that with things that we call pumps. Similarly, at a molecular scale, transport proteins that are specifically working to move things against their gradient are called pumps. Okay, so the ones that in the previous slide weren't pumps, because they were just helping out diffusion. Other kinds of transport proteins grab on to the thing and move it the opposite way that it wants to diffuse. So that really makes the cell stockpile these things, because you're grabbing them from a place where they're already lower concentration, and you're putting them on the other side of the membrane where there's already a high concentration. You're making an even higher concentration, stockpiling them. Okay, so pumps create and maintain gradients by moving things against their gradients. And that always requires energy. Now, the energy source isn't always, but it often is ATP. Right here we have ATP being used to power just one of several different kinds of pumps operating in your body. These, by pumps, I'm talking about these active transporting molecules. There's different kinds of pumps, but by far the most numerous ones in your body, you have quadrillions of these things in your body because every living cell has many of them. This pump is called the sodium-potassium exchange pump. And none of your cells would really operate, but especially your nervous cells and your muscle cells. So you don't do a good job of living without a nervous system or a muscular system, which just major examples of why you need these. The rest of the cells need them as well. But it's called sodium-potassium exchange pump because it's really two pumps in one. It simultaneously pumps sodium ions out of the cell, so that maintains a higher concentration of sodium ions in the extracellular fluid compared to the intracellular fluid, and pumps potassium ions in the opposite direction, so that maintains a higher concentration of potassium ions in the cell and a lower concentration outside the cell. And that's important for a lot of reasons, but operating these, of course, requires energy. You have so many of them that, by some estimates, about 40% of your energy budget, which means 40% of the reason you have to eat, is to continuously power these pumps for your whole life. Almost half of the energy you take in is put into running these. Okay, so that's active transport. Now on slide 22, we can get back to some more, some better pictures for vesicular transport that I already introduced. Remember that the two major subcategories of vesicular transport are endocytosis and exocytosis, and the only difference between the two, the only thing that matters, is the direction. Inward movement is endocytosis, outward movement is exocytosis. Well, we already saw this picture, basically. It's the same one that we saw before, so I'll just go on to 23. Let me say, though, that... I'll say it after this slide. Here you have a better view of exocytosis happening stage by stage. This vesicle has already been formed, so it could have budded off of the Golgi, for instance, like I was saying.
But since it's made of the same material as the plasma membrane, when the two meet, they fuse into each other. And then it just unfolds, and whatever was in that vesicle is now spilled out of the cell. That's exocytosis. And we call that secretion when a cell does that. This is how glands work, for instance. They secrete things via vesicles. 24 shows you endocytosis, but all I've given you is that word so far. Endocytosis is already a subdivision of vesicular transport, right? Inward movement. But there's different kinds of endocytosis, even though they all work the same way, really. We give them different names. We give them different names based on what kind of stuff is coming into the cell via endocytosis. And so sometimes cells are just continuously forming inward vesicles, kind of taking a sip of the liquid exterior, which is called pinocytosis, which literally means cell drinking, because you're taking a little sip of liquid from the exterior. All right? And we see that happening right here. On the other hand, another kind of endocytosis is phagocytosis. The P-H-A-G part of this means eat. So this is cell eating, literally. Well, the only difference is that what's being brought in via a vesicle is a solid chunk rather than just a part of the liquid exterior. Same process, though, just two different names for it. And then finally, in 26, we have what's called receptor-mediated endocytosis. Some endocytosis is just happening more or less continuously. It's just the cell is continuously making vesicles, bringing stuff in. But for receptor-mediated endocytosis, the cell is not bothering to make a vesicle unless it knows the correct thing is there. And it will know the correct thing is there because the cell has receptors, which are these Y-shaped proteins sticking outward, and only the right kind of thing will be able to bind to those receptors. So if that happens, the cell knows it's there, and it will then form a vesicle and endocytose it. Okay, now, 27. Another look at DNA. When we had that other look in the previous chapter, I told you that there are two major jobs that DNA performs, one of which is replication, the other is transcription. Well, replication, which means the exact copying of DNA, is the whole reason why new cells can be created. Right? Where do new cells come from? Well, they don't just pop into existence. New cells come from pre-existing cells. In general, but also specifically in your body, right? We make billions of new cells every day because you lose billions. You lose red blood cells, a hell of a lot of those. You lose a hell of a lot of skin cells every day. Those have to be replaced. Otherwise, you run out. And so when a new cell needs to be created, a cell that already exists and is living will split into two cells. So now there's more cells than you had before, because now there's two to replace one. Well, those two cells, if they're going to continue living, if they're going to do the things that are required of them, they need to have their own DNA. And they need to have the entire DNA library, not just some of the DNA. So when one cell splits into two, it doesn't give each of those two cells half of its DNA. It has to give each of those cells just as much DNA as the original cell had, right? Which means before the splitting occurs, a cell needs to double its DNA so it has enough DNA for two cells, and then it can split, and each cell will have a full complement of DNA to work with. That's why we need replication. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have cell division. And the reason that this works for DNA is because of the double-stranded nature of DNA. Not only is DNA two strands, but each strand
is complementary to the other.
The word that we use with DNA is complementarity. It's with an E, not an I.
So it's not complementing something. It's being the it kind of means the opposite of. Well, remember the A's, T's, C's, and G's, which are the four kinds of nucleotides that DNA uses? The complementarity means that wherever you have a G on one strand, in that same position, you'll always have a C on the other strand. And wherever you have an A, you'll have a T. So C with G, A with T always. And that's really important because this allows DNA to serve as a template for how to copy itself. Because if you have a double-stranded DNA, which is millions of A's, T's, and C's and G's long in some sequence, right? If you remove one of those two strands and hide it from me, but you let me look at the other strand, I can tell you exactly what the sequence is on the other strand, right? All I have to do is say, this is a T, so the other one must have been an A. This is a G, so the other one must have been a C, and so on. So when the two are separated, as they are in a cell, prior to a cell splitting, each one tells the cell how to build another copy of the other one. And when that's happening to both of the two strands, you end up with two double-strand copies, enough for two cells. Does that make sense? And then the cell splits, and each cell has its own DNA, a full amount of DNA, full library. Okay, so that's replication. What happens next, because a cell wouldn't want to do this during its normal lifetime. It does this when it gets the signal that it's about to end its own life. It's not like a mother giving birth to a child. Nowadays, the woman usually survives that, right? But when a cell reproduces, it does not survive. That original cell no longer exists. Now you have two cells to replace it. And so a cell does not replicate its DNA until it's just about ready to divide. It's before it divides, though, obviously. Well, when it does divide, you have what is overall called cell division. But that includes two important components. Mitosis is one of them, and the other is cytokinesis. Mitosis is division of the nucleus. Cytokinesis is division of everything else in the cell. All right. So this happens in these stages that are named here, but I don't want to get into the real fine details of it. The important point is that by the time this is done, the separation of the two copies of the DNA into different ends of the cell, followed by the division of the actual cell into two distinct cells, means you now have two cells, each with its own DNA. And by the way, this is not just a 50-50 split randomly, right? It has to be done very carefully so that it's not just simply 50% of the DNA, it is one full amount of DNA, and the other one is an exact copy of that. But it happens remarkably pretty well most of the times. There are very few accidents that happen in that. Okay, that brings us to 29, which is the other major job of DNA, which I already told you is transcription. But what is that? Well, transcription is just one part, there are two overall parts, of a process called gene expression. So I told you a little bit earlier that what we call a chromosome contains one enormously long double-stranded DNA, which is a sequence of millions of C's, T's, A's, and G's. Okay, that's a chromosome. What we call a gene is really just some smaller sequence within that long sequence. And there's many genes on one chromosome. Functionally, what a gene is, though, is the instructions for how indirectly to make a protein. Okay? And I say indirectly because what the DNA does directly with its information, its sequence of nucleotides in a gene, is tell the cell how to build an RNA molecule. All right? So the information is originally in the gene. That's DNA. In transcription, that code in the gene is used to make an RNA molecule. That's what transcription is. It produces the RNA directly. DNA's job is done at that point. And so no protein is made yet, right? All you have is an RNA, which is now carrying the code. It's like a non-circulating book at a library. The library is the DNA. The gene is the manual for how to build a protein, but you're not allowed to check it out. So you copy the instructions down while you're at the library and then reshelf it. DNA is done. And you have that copy of the information. That's an RNA molecule. All right. That then has to go out of the cell. Transcription occurs where the DNA is, which is inside the nucleus. The RNA then has to go out into the rest of the cell. That's why you need those nuclear pores, those holes in the nuclear envelope. And I'm almost done. Then that RNA, which is now carrying the code, meets up with a ribosome. Remember that I said ribosomes are where the proteins are actually assembled? So the ribosome is able to read that code and figure out how many amino acids, what type of amino acids, and in what order to string them together to make the protein. That actual assembly process of the protein is called translation. So gene expression, which involves DNA, RNA, and protein, consists of transcription first and then translation. Okay, now I'll quit.